Good morning, everyone. First of all, I too would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, and I pay my respects to elders past and present, and I also extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people joining us here today. So thank you for having me. This is actually a very important opportunity for me to reflect on the forces shaping the Australian economy, how these forces are shifting, and how the Monetary Policy Board is responding. So since the middle of last year, inflationary pressures have picked up, partly because capacity pressures have been stronger than we previously assessed. With underlying inflation now expected to enter the 2-3% range in mid-2027, and the labour market still tight, the board was unanimous in its decision to raise the cash rate in February. So today I'm going to set out why the board judged a rate rise to be necessary in February and how it supports our monetary policy strategy, and also how we make decisions when uncertainty is elevated. And we were reminded of that again on the weekend. I also want to explain at the end why listening directly to Australian households and businesses is essential as an input to our decision making. But I want to go back a month to start with, which is prior to the recent events in the Middle East. And I want to go back to the board meeting in February. So in its statement following its decision in February and in the subsequent minutes of the meeting, the board noted that inflation is too high and that some of the recent increase in inflation is likely to persist. Staff forecasts, which you can see here, they did not see inflation coming back into the target band until mid-2027. That's over a year away. The staff's view is that the CPI data for January, which was released after the February meeting, broadly supports this assessment. Headline inflation was 3.8% in the year to January, and it will continue to be boosted for a time by the unwinding of electricity rebates. But measures of underlying inflation, which strip out some of the temporary price moves, are also above the top end of our 2-3% target band. High inflation imposes real costs on people in the economy. It puts pressure on household budgets, which means people need to spend more time searching for the lowest prices and working out how to make ends meet. This can be stressful and it can force some tough decisions. We don't want families to have to cut back on after-school activities for their children or to delay non-urgent medical care. And we certainly don't want people to go without essentials. These are just some of the real costs of high inflation for all Australians that we're trying to avoid. But higher inflation also makes it harder for businesses to plan. When businesses have to spend more time managing rising costs, they have less time to plan how they can grow through investment and productivity improvements. Even when businesses have growth plans, high inflation creates uncertainty, and that can lead them to delay those plans. This is why low and stable inflation matters. It eases strain on household budgets and it creates conditions businesses need to invest and lift productivity. Now, we've spent quite a lot of time thinking about the recent increase in inflation and whether this will continue. Temporary factors have played a part, as my colleague Michael Plumb said in a speech last week. But we judge that some of the inflation pressures are because demand exceeds the economy's supply capacity. Around 6 months ago, we thought that demand and supply would soon be close to balance. But we now think demand was outstripping supply over the second half of last year. And there are a few reasons for this. Firstly, private demand has been stronger than expected. Global conditions have proved more resilient than many feared after the tariff announcements last year, notwithstanding what's happened over the weekend. And financial conditions have been more supportive of growth than anticipated. Secondly, the economy's supply capacity appears to have been somewhat lower than previously assessed. And with our updated judgment that underlying demand exceeds that supply potential, inflation is likely to remain above target until those pressures ease. That assessment was central to the board's decision to increase the cash rate last month. Now, as you know, the board looks at the closely at the labour market when making its decisions under our dual mandate. We aim to keep not only inflation low and stable, but also to achieve full employment, which and full employment is the highest level of employment that's consistent with low and stable inflation. Last year, we were concerned that there was a risk the labour market could weaken materially. That's not happened, which is very welcome, and the labour market was resilient through 2025. In fact, recent labour market outcomes have come in stronger than we anticipated mid-last year, as my colleague Sarah Hunter highlighted in a speech a few weeks ago. Unemployment is still low, the vacancies to unemployment ratio is high, and growth in unit labour costs remains elevated. While we expect labour market conditions to ease over time as the economy comes back into balance, we still assess it is tight overall. Our judgment in February was that capacity pressures in the labour market and the economy more broadly contributed to the recent increase in inflation, and it was appropriate to tighten policy. The danger we faced was that leaving interest rates unchanged would risk having inflation above target for longer, ultimately requiring a more aggressive tightening later and a more costly adjustment in the labour market. Another concern is that the longer inflation stays above target, the greater the risk that people expect inflation to stay high. While measures of longer-term inflation expectations remain stable, near-term expectations have increased a little over the past 6 months. Now, we're alert to this risk, and we closely monitor expectations using surveys, our business and community liaison program, and financial market-based measures. I'm often asked to give more guidance on the direction of monetary policy, and as you know, I'm reluctant to do so. This is because we set policy in an inherently uncertain environment, from unexpected developments here and overseas, as well as uncertainty around our own assessments, our forecasts, and our models. That means judging a range of risks and how they might play out. Sometimes the answer is more obvious. So when inflation was climbing quickly after the pandemic and the cash rate was practically at zero, interest rates clearly had to rise. But there are other times when the answer is much less clear. The past few days have seen a significant escalation in conflict and instability in the Middle East, which is deeply concerning. The human cost, I think, is particularly regrettable, and we sincerely hope conditions improve quickly for all the civilians affected. But these events are a timely reminder that in this world of geopolitical uncertainty, things can change quickly. It's too early to say what the economic impact will be. Events are moving rapidly, and there are different ways that this can play out. We're going to take some time to make sense of what it could mean for inflation here. A supply shock of this nature, for example, could add to inflation pressures. And the potential implications for inflation expectations also are something that we're very alert to. At the same time, a prolonged impact on energy markets could have adverse effects on global economic activity and result in downward pressure on inflation. And it's not obvious how this might play out. So as much as I know the public would like more certainty about the direction of interest rates, it would be wrong for us to pretend we have greater certainty than we do. But that doesn't mean the board throws up its hands and says it's all too hard. On the contrary, the staff set out their view of the most likely central case outcome for the major economic variables, and that's an important input into the board's discussions. And then we look at a range of scenarios to understand how the economic outlook might change and how policy might need to respond in those circumstances. Most importantly, if it becomes clear the economy has evolved differently than our earlier expectations, and that difference is likely to endure, then we adjust the stance of policy, which we did in February. Our approach to dealing with uncertainty varies depending on the context. For example, global developments can be significant drivers of economic outcomes in small open economies like Australia, and are therefore a major source of uncertainty. These developments take many forms, as we see. Some stem from shocks to global demand, for example, due to slower economic growth in our key trading partners. For these kinds of shocks, we have history. We have economic frameworks and models to help us understand the range of possible implications for the Australian economy and inform our decisions. Sometimes, however, as was the case in the pandemic, these events are unique and history is not a great guide for how they will play out. These situations require us to supplement our models with informed judgments about the range of possible outcomes. There are also more ambiguous sources of uncertainty where it can be difficult to pin down the implications for our economy. So over the past few years, we have seen a ratcheting up of geopolitical uncertainty, and as I noted, the recent events in the Middle East are a manifestation of that. These types of uncertainties are complex because there are many ways that events could unfold, and so they can't easily be captured in our models. To inform our judgments in such cases, we speak and listen to others with a variety of perspectives to work through a plausible range of scenarios. Such conversations, for example, help staff to simulate the effects of trade tensions under different assumptions using scenario analysis. We published that in May 2025. This helped the board think through issues quantitatively. That said, it is impossible to predict outcomes with any degree of confidence for this sort of uncertainty. Instead, we need to ensure we can position monetary policy to respond if needed. With the cash rate currently at 3.85% and the economy closer to balance than it was a few years ago, we believe we are well positioned for such a response if it were to be required. But it's not only future shocks we need to consider. We also face uncertainty about where the economy stands right now. Our real-time assessment of economic conditions, which underpins the view of our outlook, is always uncertain. The data we rely on can be noisy, incomplete, and are usually released with a lag. Some key concepts, like spare capacity, which I've been talking about, they can't be observed directly, despite being critical for the medium-term inflation outlook. So in such cases, we must form a judgment. Sometimes, when the strength of capacity pressures is clear, these judgments are relatively straightforward. So in the middle of 2022, for example, inflation had surged to above 7%, unemployment was very low at 3.5%, and job vacancies were very high, all strong and consistently indicating the economy was running hot and that monetary policy would need to be tightened. But when the economy is closer to balance and demand is near its supply potential, it becomes harder to know whether monetary policy needs to shift to bring inflation back to target. The data can send mixed signals. So in forming an assessment about spare capacity, we also incorporate qualitative information. This is the situation we found ourselves in August last year, when underlying inflation had been steadily declining and was approaching the midpoint of the target band, consistent with the economy returning to balance. But at the same time, several indicators and model estimates pointed to ongoing tightness in the labour market and the economy more broadly. The board needed to weigh these mixed signals carefully and acknowledge the risk that capacity pressures could be tighter than assessed, which would mean higher inflation than staff had forecast at that time. As it turned out, inflation did pick up, in part because the risk was realised. At the margin, recent labour market data point to the risk that conditions may in fact be tightening. This is the environment we are operating in now. The judgments about whether the economy is running a bit too hot are not straightforward, but we still need to make them. It also underscores why it's so important for monetary policy to be data-driven. Now, being data-driven doesn't mean we react to every new number or look solely in the rearview mirror. Instead, monetary policy must respond to the outlook for inflation and employment because interest rates take time to affect the economy. This means drawing on all the available evidence to keep testing and refining our central view and our view of the risks around it. So I've spoken about how traditional economic data and models can tell us a great deal about what's happening in the economy right now and where the economy might be in a year or so. But they cannot always explain what's driving those developments or whether they are likely to continue. That's why we also draw on what we hear through our business liaison program about what organisations are seeing now and what they expect next. Our liaison program has been running since 2001. And in that time, our staff have conducted almost 23,000 interviews with businesses and community organisations. We have teams in Adelaide, Brisbane, Melbourne, Perth and Sydney, and we get to other capital cities and regional centres regularly too. I was personally in Geelong only last week speaking with the business community. The qualitative information we gather plays an important role in our economic analysis and forecasting process, particularly in times of high uncertainty or of rapid change, where economic data and models may fall short. For example, in early 2022, the board agreed that timely evidence from liaison and business surveys indicated that labour cost pressures were building even though this was not yet evident in traditional data. The wage and price outcomes and expectations reported by firms through Liaison have historically had a high correlation with the private wage price index and the CPI, and are therefore a useful input into our assessment of current inflationary pressures. But listening to businesses and the community matters for more than just our forecasts. Our role is to serve the Australian public, and that starts with hearing what people are experiencing. In early 2025, we expanded these efforts by introducing a new survey of the Australian public in step with peer central banks. The survey tells us a great deal about the key issues Australians are facing, as well as their understanding of monetary policy and the economy. It also gives us direct insights into the public's level of trust in the RBA. Maintaining public understanding, trust and confidence is critical because it underpins our ability to achieve our policy objectives and to maintain our independence. One survey consistently identified inflation as the public's top concern in 2025, perhaps unsurprising given inflation has been elevated for some time. At the same time, most surveyed households viewed their own job security as being at or above average, consistent with the labour market remaining a bit tight. Importantly, while many households reported that their financial situations were steady or improving, some others told us they were doing it tough. For example, turning to family, friends, or community organisations for financial support, or struggling to meet rent or mortgage payments. This echoes similar concerns that community service providers tell us via our Liaison program about cost of living pressures and the lack of affordable housing. These results are not new to us, but the survey has helped us to better understand how economic conditions are being felt across communities. The findings also underscore the real costs of high inflation. Achieving our objectives of low and stable inflation and full employment is the best way for the RBA to contribute to these pressures. Listening to the public is also important for building and maintaining trust. Because the RBA is independent of government, transparency and accountability of the public is critically important. Trust is important for monetary policy transmission too, and our survey provides evidence that people with higher levels of trust in the RBA tend to have inflation expectations that are better anchored to the 2-3% target. This next graph summarises some of the results of the survey. The survey asked people to provide trust scores. The higher these are, the higher the reported level of trust in the RBA. And one of the key takeaways from the survey is that it suggests that public trust in the RBA in 2025 was around the average of other Council of Financial Regulator agencies. And I can also say it's around about the same level as peer central banks. And you can see this in the left panel of the graph. Importantly, though, the survey also highlights that trust in the RBA varies considerably across segments of our society. And that's shown in the right panel of the graph. Trust in the RBA is lower for women and young people, and for people with lower levels of economic literacy and understanding of the RBA's role and functions. So it therefore follows that if we are to build trust, we need to work hard to explain how economic conditions affect everyone and what the RBA is doing to achieve, is trying to achieve when it sets monetary policy and fulfills its other functions. So we're now developing strategies to better engage with and reach all segments of the community. I think encouragingly, the survey suggests that most Australians do value staying informed and want to learn more about the economy and monetary policy. So we plan to continue to survey the Australian public to track our progress and to identify the things we need to focus on. We'll be publishing more insights from this survey later this year. So I'm going to conclude by returning to our assessment of the current outlook for the economy. At this juncture, we think a large part of the unexpected increase in inflation since the middle of last year was due to sector-specific demand and price pressures that we expect to ease in coming quarters. But economy-wide capacity pressures in the economy are also playing a role. And overall, we think underlying demand in the economy is further from its supply potential than we had assessed 6 months ago. A range of indicators tell us that labour market conditions are tight, and it's uncertain whether financial conditions are sufficiently restrictive to return inflation to the midpoint of the target in a reasonable time frame. Add to that the uncertainty of the events in the Middle East and the potential impact of that on the Australian economy, and you'll see that we have some difficult decisions to make. So if I take all this together, the board judged that the inflation outlook warranted an increase in the cash rate in February. The staff's view at the data we've seen since then broadly support their assessment of the outlook at that time of the decision. We do remain focused on returning inflation to target, and we will be focusing on the data and the ructions and events from overseas to try to determine, in a great deal of uncertainty, what this means for the economy and the outlook. So thank you for that, and happy to talk to John now.
Well, thanks very much, Governor Bullock, for that address, but also joining us at the Australian Financial Review Business Summit. It is auspiciously timed again. In 2020, it was on the cusp of COVID lockdowns. In 2022, it was around the time that Russia had just invaded Ukraine. And now here we are with events going on in the Middle East and Iran in the last couple of days. I know you touched on it there in your speech, but can I just follow up and ask, how worried personally are you about the events folding on there in terms of the potential economic flow and implications? And are you somewhat relieved, at least in the early stages, that we haven't seen a worst case scenario economically, at least in terms of something like the Strait of Hormuz closing down?
So the first point to make, I guess, is that it's very early days. We don't know what exactly is going to happen. The markets so far have... Yes, there's been some oil prices have risen, gas prices have risen, as you'd expect. There has been yields have moved a little bit. There's been a bit of movement in expectations about what central banks might do with monetary policy. But basically, it's been pretty orderly. Equity markets have reacted as you might have expected. So that's all been pretty orderly. Last year, we've been doing conceptual thinking about what might happen if there is prolonged increase in energy prices. You'll recall last year when there was the 12-day Israel-Iran conflict, and at the time we, along with many others, were thinking conceptually about how that might particularly impact Australia. And again, it's complex. On the one hand, we're a net energy exporter, so energy prices rising might assist us. It might assist our terms of trade. That might be positive for us in terms of income. But on the other hand, we're a net importer of oil, which obviously has big implications for inflation, particularly for headline inflation and what people see at the pump. The other possibility is that if this is a very prolonged conflict and there is a very, very elevated and lengthy rise in energy prices, this ultimately is going to feed through into economic activity. And I think uncertainty... if people are paying more for their petrol, they've got less money to spend on other things, this might impact consumption. If businesses are uncertain, that might impact investment. So all these things might impact the economy. So at the same time as there's potentially a inflationary impact, there's also potentially, if a very elongated conflict, there's also the potential for it to be impacting economic activity, not just here but around the world. So it's not 100% clear in our case. And one thing that I think we are doing is we've done a lot of conceptual work here. Now I think we'll be doing more work on particular scenarios. I talked a little bit about, you'll recall in May, we published a scenario when the trade war was looking quite bad. But this might be an opportunity now, and I think we will take the opportunity now to think about some scenarios around energy prices and the war.
Traditionally, central banks, including the RBA, look through supply shocks, such as a temporary increase in oil prices because of conflict, or you know, other examples over the years have been cyclones pushing up the cost of fruit and vegetables temporarily. But I suppose we find ourselves in an interesting situation at the moment where inflation is already elevated in Australia. So does that complicate your task? If we do get some sort of prolonged supply shock here, is the look through the easy thing to do, or do you actually have to say, actually, that could be a risk for inflation more sustainably because we've already got high inflation anyway?
Yeah, I think that's a very relevant point. We do have inflation which is already elevated, and as I said, inflation, short-term inflation expectations have picked up a bit, but mostly longer-term they're anchored. With a supply shock occurring in a situation where we already have high inflation, I think there is a risk that inflation expectations may start to move. So that will be something I think that will be at front of mind for the board. Are we in a position where it's difficult to look through, particularly if it's an elongated shock? You mentioned some of the instances where it's quite easy to look through the shock, but this one might be a little bit harder because, as you say, we already have elevated inflation, and I think there is a risk that inflation expectations might become a little bit unanchored.
You said last week that we need to be patient for all inflation to come down and return to sort of normal sort of target levels. Mm. I just wanted to ask, what do you mean by being patient? And given that inflation is around 3.8%, unemployment's low at 4.1%. Is there a risk that you are being too patient in terms of getting inflation under control?
Well, that is a very good question because, as we've spoken about before, the board's strategy has been to try and bring inflation down to target in a reasonable time frame while preserving the gains in employment. That has been the strategy, and I think it still is the strategy. But it does beg the question of how patient can we be. When I was talking about being patient, I think I was using it in two ways. One is there is always a thirst in the Australian public for understanding what is happening to interest rates next. And I think in one sense what I was saying to people, look, just be patient while the board sifts through the information and then we will be able to decide what to do. So there's part of that. I notice even with the events in the Middle East now, the focus in Australia is on what does this mean for interest rates and housing prices. So I meant patient in that sense, but I also mean that We want to be patient in bringing inflation down, but also it's critical, and I said this in the speech and I've said it a number of times, the board is really focused on inflation expectations. We've been able to achieve this because inflation expectations have been anchored. If we see that they are not, then interest rates are going to have to respond.
And so the market seems to think that you only tend to entertain the idea of moving interest rates up or down essentially every second meeting after you get a full quarterly inflation print. Now, ahead of the March 16-17 meeting, we're not getting another inflation read. We've only had one monthly number. It was still elevated in line with the previous quarter. Could you see a scenario where you'll seriously consider an interest rate rise at that meeting, even though we don't have a full in quarterly inflation print? And are people underestimating the prospect that you could move not just every second meeting, but in consecutive meetings?
Yes, every meeting is live. And if you go back when we were coming out of COVID, for example, and inflation was shooting towards 7%, we weren't waiting for quarterly meetings then. We were moving much more quickly. Then you'll recall, actually, when the markets expected us to move in July last year and we didn't, that caused a lot of angst as well. And now I think they're settled on the fact that we only go every quarter. I would dissuade them from thinking that. I'm not making a prediction about March, but it will be a live meeting. We have inflation at 3.8% headline and we have unemployment at 4.1, tight. The board will be actively looking at whether or not it needs to move more quickly. So I would discourage people from thinking that we necessarily only move every quarter.
You recently said the economy is in a good position with low unemployment, the economy close to balance. But given inflation is forecast to be above 2.5%, at least in underlying terms, for almost 7 years until 2028, What do you say to some of the critics who actually say you're putting too much emphasis on maintaining employment ahead of the mandate of actually getting inflation down?
Well, we do have a dual mandate, and we do have to consider employment when we are trying to bring inflation down. Now, as I've said before, there are critics who said we should have increased interest rates much, much higher, and that would have resulted in unemployment being much higher. And I think Sarah Hunter gave a speech in which she, a couple of nights ago, or it might have been last night, where she actually put some scenarios through about what would have happened if we'd responded more forcefully. Like New Zealand and Canada, who now have unemployment rates with fives and sixes in front of them. So yes, we could have done that. And in many ways, that would have been the very easy decision. We tried to do something which was a little bit harder, and I don't think we ever thought it would be easy. If you look back to the middle of the year last year, it looked like things were unfolding in a favourable way, but things changed and we had to change. So I think we're not putting too much emphasis on unemployment. We are trying to look at where the risks lie. At the moment, they lie, we think, more on the inflation side, so we're paying more attention to that. We're focusing on that, and that's, I think, going to be a very important part of the board's decision over the next little while, because that's where the risks lie.
I wanted to turn the conversation to artificial intelligence, which is obviously a massive talking point at the moment in business and economic circles and broader society as well. Last week, we saw WiseTech announce it was cutting 2,000 jobs. Block, the owner of Afterpay, slashed 40% of its workforce, and even CBA eliminated about 300 jobs, and that was partly attributed to AI. Where do you sort of lie in terms of, is this going to be a very disruptive force for the labour market in the short term, or are you more optimistic, given that actually the labour market at the moment seems very, very resilient to all this?
So AI, you've got a full spectrum here. You've got people who are in the, it's an absolute disaster scenario in the next year or so, and heaps of people are going to be out of work. And then you've got people at the relatively optimistic side of things that think, well, no, it's going to help with productivity, and ultimately that will be positive for employment. We've done a little bit of works with our business liaison program, asking businesses what they're thinking about these sorts of issues. And broadly, I think the feedback we're getting is that, look, there haven't been a lot of job losses to AI yet. Yes, there are some headline numbers, but not a lot yet. They don't expect over the next 12 months or so, really, it to impact their workforces significantly. I think there's two reasons for that. One is that, and this is a lesson I think from other technologies as well, when they come in, is that it takes businesses time to reorganise their business processes to really take advantage of the technology to get automate those sorts of things. So I think where people are looking at automation, they're looking at ways of people being able to use AI to improve their own productivity. And so ultimately there might be certain, and we're hearing stories about certain types of jobs that will probably suffer severe job losses. But what we don't know is where the new jobs will come from. So, I've told this story a few times, but when I was starting at the Reserve Bank, we had a massive typing pool. And then within 5 years, it was completely gone. And where did the jobs come up? Well, the jobs came up, technology was coming through at the time, so there was a whole lot of jobs that people didn't even know you'd need in your organisation. Coders and those sorts of things. These are all jobs that came through. So we don't know where the new jobs might come from in these circumstances. So I'm probably not in the it's a disaster camp. I think there is going to be disruption and there is going to be potential challenges in the labour market as people that thought they had jobs, those jobs are getting automated and they don't, and they're often lower entry jobs. But I also think that history tells us that there will be jobs that will come up. We just don't know what they are yet. Doesn't mean there's not going to be pains in the middle.
There's a lot of talk about productivity, and it's been fairly stagnant in Australia for the last decade. Could AI be our get out of jail card on productivity? We're seeing some evidence in the US, some of the recent pickup in productivity late last year is being attributed to AI. Could that happen here?
I think it could. And certainly, as you say, some people attribute recent pickup to that. And I think I've described myself as a productivity optimist. I think there is potential for AI to improve productivity. Take out those low-level tasks. I mean, even internally, we've discovered we're not getting rid of people, but we're finding that people can automate some low-level tasks and they can concentrate on analytics. And so a very simple example of this is we've developed a little bot to utilising AI to access all our liaison notes over since 2001 and draw themes out of it. So that means that we don't have an analyst sitting there going through every single note trying to draw out themes. They can get the bot to do it and then they can use that to advance their own analysis. So I think those sorts of things will help to improve productivity. I'm sure that many businesses around here are looking for similar sorts of uses of AI to assist their, not only to take cost out, but also to assist their teams to concentrate on what is important and what's more commercially important.
If we can't revive productivity, it looks like the speed limit on the Australian economy is only about 2% or so, according to your sort of RBA forecast. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of that more broadly if we can only grow at that sort of modest rate?
The implications are that we can't have demand growing at basically more than 2%, which means that people can't consume, investment can't grow, because it's putting too much pressure on the supply capacity of the economy. Ironically, investment is needed to advance the supply capacity of the economy as well. Demand, we're used to sort of growth rates of 2.5% to 3% in Australia. Unless we can get better productivity growth, we're not going to be seeing that. We're going to be seeing sluggish growth.
I know you're not in the habit of giving free advice to governments on specific policies, but we do have federal and state government budgets coming up over the next 3 to 4 months. In a general sort of gist, what would you be hoping to see connected to that sort of productivity theme?
I'd be hoping, a couple of things. I think, at least from what they say, I think most governments are very conscious of a few issues. One is productivity. Another is housing, which is a really important part of important to the Australian people, and rightly so. Another issue is inflation. I think they're all conscious of inflation. But as I've said earlier, governments have difficult jobs. They have to provide infrastructure. They have to provide services. What I guess I'd be asking for them to do is just to, in thinking about that, in thinking about their spending plans and their infrastructure plans, where can they be making those investments that might assist productivity? And where can they be looking to remove regulations and frictions that are preventing perhaps mobility of labour, those sorts of things that might help with productivity. So I have no specific asks for them, but just for them to keep those things at front of mind.
There's some of the state government infrastructure projects, there's a lot of spending at the moment. Private sector business investment is recovering. We're running into capacity constraints in terms of labour, resources, materials for all those sort of similar projects. Is there a risk of crowding out there from those state infrastructure projects against private sector activity?
I think that's sort of in the construction sector. We hear that that is happening in some areas. So there is a bit of a crossover between not so much detached housing, but high density and state infrastructure projects and Commonwealth infrastructure projects. There is a crossover between the resources required there. So We hear that that is making it difficult in those sorts of circumstances. So yes, I think, and that's when I say that when I talk about, in a very generic sense, supply, demand is excess to the ability of the economy to supply. I think the construction industry is a concrete example of where you can see that pressure building.
We've got a question on Slido here from the audience, and I'll sort of succinctly summarise it. You cut interest rates three times last year. With what we know now about the resurgence in inflation, unemployment remaining low, was it premature to do all those three rate cuts? Did we do too much too early? Was there some sort of error or mistake there?
Interestingly, when we were easing during that period, people were expecting we would ease further. So we weren't the only people, quite frankly, thinking that inflation was coming back down to target, and we were seeing relatively weak growth in demand. And so when we were sort of did those three rate cuts, if we hadn't been doing those three rate cuts, I suspect people would be saying inflation's back in the target band, what are you doing? You're late. So hindsight is a wonderful thing. What we were doing was following what we thought was the most, at that time, was the most likely outcome, our central forecast for the economy, and therefore what we were doing was, I think, at the time, right. What we've subsequently found out, of course, is that there was stronger demand in the second half than we'd initially thought. So we've had to revise our forecasts and we've had to change our outlook on interest rates based on that. And I think that's what you'd expect us to do. If circumstances change and we get new information, you'd expect us to react if it's not going the direction we thought it would. So I can't say that our forecasts will be right this time. Forecasting is inherently difficult, and I hope I gave a bit of a flavour of that in my speech. But we've got to do it, we've got to do our best, and we have to be prepared, if we think we're going to be wrong, to change direction.
Unemployment's a low 4.1%. The Reserve Bank's latest estimate of full employment, or the so-called non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, is 4.6%. It's quite a bit higher. Mm. Does that mean, in all likelihood, to get inflation back to the 2.5% band, when unemployment is going to have to rise to around that sort of level? And are you prepared to take it there if you need to get inflation back to the target band?
Well, we've got, if the labour market remains tight and there's continued pressure on inflation, then one of the things that's going to happen is the inflation rate will, unemployment rate will probably have to rise. I want to be clear here, though, that people often say, when I say the unemployment rate has to rise, they do a quick calculation in their head and they say, Michelle wants 100,000 people to lose their jobs. No, that's not what I want. I clearly don't want that. The unemployment rate can rise for a variety of reasons, not because people are necessarily losing their jobs, that people are finding it harder to find jobs. The skills mismatches, they might find that the skills they have are not any required, so they find themselves unable to get a job for that reason. So it's a subtle point, but it's an important point. The unemployment rate rises, it will ease a bit of pressure on the labour market, and that will ultimately help to bring inflation down. In a sense, we talk about this nebulous concept of excess demand, and the way it really manifests itself in a very concrete way is in the labour market. So we can't measure precisely the excess demand gap. We can't measure precisely this so-called NIRU. But we look at a lot of labour market indicators, and all of those help us to assess whether we think the labour market's tight, and that's telling us something about the supply capacity of the economy.
Just briefly on the currency, in trade-weighted terms, it's up about 6% in recent times, which is quite a jump in a short amount of time. How's the RBA thinking about that in terms of putting downward pressure on inflation?
So this is actually, again, quite a subtle point. Our estimates suggest that the appreciation in the currency is simply reflecting what we would expect to happen to the currency with the interest rate differentials moving the way they are. Our interest rates are rising relative to others, interest rate differentials rising, and that means that will result in a rise in the currency, and it looks to be historically moving in the same way it has historically. That is part of the normal transmission mechanism of monetary policy, one of the ways in which it impacts. So we don't think it's doing anything out of the ordinary at this time. We think it's just doing what it normally does in response to interest differentials.
We are just about out of time, Governor, but on a slightly lighter note, I know you're a keen runner, swimmer, I believe, as well. Have you got any upcoming events? Are you training? How does that sort of influence your sort of mental and physical state to be in the office? Is it part of your sort of routine as well?
Yeah, no, I try to get out in the... I didn't this morning. I had to study. I normally...
You've passed the exam.
I would normally try to do something, a bit of a run or a bit of exercise in the morning before I... I'm training for a half marathon in May, John, so I've got to get out and get more running done.
I think we cheekily tracked down a photo of you running a half marathon around the time you were named governor as well, so photographers take note. Michelle Bullock, RBA Governor, thanks very much for joining us at the Financial Review Business Summit. Great to have you here.
Thanks, John. Thank you.